Welcome to the New Books Network.
While many have noted the general Jewishness of the Gospel of John, few have given it a seat at the ideologically crowded table of ancient Jewish practice and belief until now. Join us as we speak with Wally Serafesi, whose book, John Within Judaism, offers a reading of the Gospel of John as an expression of the fluid and flexible nature of Jewish identity in Greco-Roman antiquity. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Wally Serafesi obtained his PhD from the University of Oslo, where he is visiting researcher in the Faculty of Theology. He has published on a range of topics related to the New Testament, ancient Judaism, and early Christianity, including verbal aspect and synoptic parallels. Wally, welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
So how did you get interested in reading the New Testament from a Jewish perspective or within Judaism?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, it's hard to know where to start. You know, my academic journey has been a long one. I suppose, I mean, it's always interested me to read really any text, not just the New Testament, but within its historical context. So I'm a big history guy. I'm a historical context guy. And I mean, I even went to when I did my undergraduate degree, you know, I was in history education was sort of my thing. So I've always been interested in sort of the larger surrounding of the ancient world, especially as I got into New Testament studies. So, you know, but it really wasn't until I deeply engaged with the world of early Judaism, particularly its literature and then even a bit of its archaeology as well, that I really started to get interested in early Judaism for itself, not even just as sort of a background for the New Testament, but just to understand sort of this world that we call Second Temple Judaism. And so, I mean, you know, that world is so rich in terms of its sources, all of the problems, of course, that are there too, in terms of, you know, how to actually study it, all the questions that are there methodologically. And so the more I got into it, so it was around the, you know, the time I was working on my master's degree, I took some coursework in Second Temple period Judaism. I knew that I wanted to kind of make my living there somehow. So I was, you know, I was interested in the Bible, of course, as well. I was interested in the New Testament, but it wasn't really until I started my doctoral work under the supervision of a guy named Anders Runesen, where I started to get interacting a little bit more with this idea of reading the New Testament not just against the background of early Judaism or Second Temple period Judaism, but actually as a part of it, right, and as an expression of sort of the intense you know, diversity that existed in this period. And of course, that's the period of Jesus. It's the period of the time in which the Gospels were written, and especially the Gospel of John. So so it was sort of, you know, I think it started just with an interest in context, interest in history. And then the more I got into it, the more I just, I think, really understood, at least from my perspective, not everybody agrees with me, of course, but from my perspective, the New Testament really belongs there, right, as an expression of the diversity of Second Temple period Judaism.
Why is this topic so important for studies of the Gospel of John?
Yeah, I mean, that's also a really good question. Because I think, you know, there are some parts of the New Testament that are less contentious when it comes to, you know, how well or how comfortably does this particular document sit within its, you know, Second Temple period Jewish context. So, you know, there's less debate about, you know, the Gospel of Matthew, for instance. I mean, there's some, of course, and how it fits, you know, within this sort of time period in this body of literature, but less so. The Gospel of John is a little bit more contentious because it has, you know, these really difficult passages to interpret when you have Jesus sort of saying some really nasty things about a group of people called Hoi Eudaioi, right, or the Jews. And so for a long time, you know, people have acknowledged that John is in some way indebted to a Second Temple period Jewish context. I mean, there's no doubt about that, right, that John sort of sits in that world. But for the most part, scholarship has suggested that John, you know, through its narrative construction, is sort of on the way out, so to say, right? So it's part of this idea of the so-called parting of the ways between Judaism and Christianity. And John is kind of encouraging readers to think now, even though maybe the John, and by nature the Johannine Jesus is sort of in Judaism at this point in time. Well, it's trying to move its readers outside of it. But I wanted to question that. I wanted to suggest that, well, if we really consider this issue of diversity, right, within Second Temple period Judaism, both before and after the time of Jesus, both before and after the time of the New Testament, then actually the Gospel of John as well, even with its harsh criticism of the Iudaioi or the Jews, and with its some of its difficult passages, actually does fit within what we know about how ancient Jews constructed their identities in very different ways sometimes, even competing, right, in very, very sort of contentious ways, but still as a part of this milieu. Again, not everybody agrees with me, but that's also what makes it fun, and that's also what makes it really important when it comes to the study of the Gospel of John.
Chapter 5 of your work focuses on the ancestral land in John's Gospel. Would you rehearse for us some of your findings here?
With this category of the quote unquote the land, what I try to do in the book, and I think as readers will get a really quick sort of glimpse of, is I try to understand the Jewish people, or sort of the Jewish nation, quote unquote, as just like any other people group in antiquity, right? So, in sort of the larger period of the Greco-Roman world, you have all these different groups of people, all these ethne, so to say, that constructed their ideas about what it meant to be part of an ethnic group. And there are, in general, about four different categories that sort of cohered, or that ethnic identity sort of cohered around in the ancient world. And ideas about an ancestral land is one of them, right? So we see lots of other groups thinking about what does it mean to have this kind of attachment to an ancestral land? And in general, I mean, again, there's lots of variation, but in general, if you look at the broader world of sort of the Mediterranean, of the Eastern Mediterranean, you have lots of groups thinking differently depending on where they are, both geographically and also where they stand politically as well, in terms of who's controlling their land, right? And so sometimes you have this idea of a quote unquote homeland religion that is constructed, where you have really strong ideas about having a statehood and a national cult that is not just sort of something that you can access anywhere in the world, but it's really it's land based, right? And so all these kind of ideas about what does it mean to be attached to a land that is sort of nationally or state based, so to say. But then you have an alternative, or kind of a different way of constructing one's attachment to the land, and or this idea of land, ancestral land, and that's what it sometimes is called diasporic, or sort of a diasporic form of religious expression. And so, within this kind of construction of identity, the land can take on a wholly different perspective. So, and access to it is also conceived very differently. So, in some contexts, you have some diasporic context, that is, you have the birth of what we sometimes call apocalyptic literature, or in other words, this idea that you can access your ancestral land and cult in a way that is not actually concretely tied to the actual land as real political territory. You can access it anywhere. The gods start to move around. They become more portable in that sense, right? And we see that in Greco-Roman texts, not just Jewish ones. We see this in Jewish ones as well, of course. But if you have that kind of basic landscape in this period of time, both Jews are doing this and non-Jews as well. I suggested that, well, John could be up to the same thing, right? And so let's look at what John is doing with this idea of the ancestral Jewish land. For the long time, scholars have suggested, especially based on John chapter. Is it John chapter 18? I suppose it's been a little while. We have this idea of my kingdom is not of this world, Jesus says in his engagement with Pilate, right? And so for a long time, people have just suggested, well, the land just doesn't mean anything to the Johannine Jesus, right? I mean, John is just sort of off doing his spiritual thing without any real interest in this category of ancestral land. And I've suggested that no, I mean, certainly John is trying to re-territorialize or reconceive of what does it mean to be attached to an ancestral land, certainly, but he's not doing it in a way that is somehow un-Jewish or in a, a sort of new Christian kind of idea or spiritualizing of the idea of land. He's doing it in a way that takes into account a diasporic form of Jewish identity, right? And so even if you look, this is also where some of the early rabbinic literature is helpful. We have this idea of the land or the world to come, right? Or in other Second Temple period Jewish literature, you have ideas of sort of an apocalypticized or an apocalyptic land or an apocalyptic temple, those kinds of things, where God and land are reconceived or reimagined. So that's what I suggested that John is doing. John fits in the sort of diasporic movement of reconceiving of the idea of land, the land of Israel, that is. But he's doing it in a way, or the gospel is doing it in a way where real political territory is not necessarily unimportant. You still have key ideas like, Jesus being the king of Israel and these kinds of ideas as well. But what the Johannine Jesus seems to be up to is conceiving of access to the land and access to particularly the God of Israel in ways that would be relevant and accessible to those living outside of the land for whatever reason, whether it's because of the destruction of the temple or other kinds of displacement types of context. So that's chapter five.
How does John's gospel relate to the temple and synagogue?
Yeah, so those two ideas are connected, temple and synagogue, but I think they're worth talking about separately. So within the context of Johannine scholarship, the temple has gotten a lot of attention, right? So especially in John chapter two, we have this idea of Jesus saying that destroy this temple and I will raise it up again in 3 days, and then the narrator makes that comment, right, that he was referring to the temple of his body, right? And so interpreters have really latched on to this kind of idea that John has a temple Christology, right? That the temple is really important for understanding John's Christology, which is true. I think that's absolutely true. But I think fundamentally linked to that temple Christology in a lot of scholarship, I think, is the idea that, well, Jesus is somehow replacing the temple. So there's like a real replacement theology kind of built into this, oftentimes tied to other sort of concepts like supersessionism or sort of Christian supersessionism, where John has in mind this new kind of religious movement that, whether we call it Christianity or not, is somehow distinct from Judaism and somehow replaces, is somehow better than Judaism and all that Judaism has to offer with regard to the temple. And I suggested that that's not the case. I mean, we can go really conveniently to an ancient Jewish thinker called Philo. Philo of Alexandria, very well known philosopher from Alexandria, Egypt. And in some of his writings, you have actually three different kind of ideas about what constitutes temple, right? And of course, Philo is writing in a diasporic context, right? He's not in Judea. He doesn't have daily access to the temple. Some scholars suggest that he actually never even made it to Jerusalem. Others have suggested that he made at least one trip to Jerusalem himself. So someone who's a very key Jewish thinker, but also removed from the temple. But he can think of the temple, of course, as the real concrete building, right, made with human hands. But of course, he can think about the temple as the community of the faithful, right, or believers in the God of Israel, or the people of Israel. And then he can also think of the soul, right, as the house of God, right. So there are all of these ways that, I mean, Philo himself, and we see this reflected in some other sources too, that Jews thought about sacred space or sanctuary space, more specifically, in very different ways, and not to the exclusion, right, or not to the replacement of the actual real temple in Jerusalem, right? And so I suggested that, that even though absolutely John has this a very important framework, this temple framework through which to understand Jesus and his mission and his divine identity, all these kinds of things, that Jesus is doing this also in tandem or in complementary fashion with the temple that's actually standing in Jerusalem. He can still call it, for example, his father's house, right? If the temple didn't mean anything to Jesus, he wouldn't call it his father's house. At least that's my own orientation, my own perspective. So, yeah, and so there's some other complicated things, especially when it com surrounds John chapter 4, when Jesus is engaged with the Samaritan woman, and he's talking about true worship not being in Jerusalem or on this mountain, with reference to Mount Gerizim. But I think it's reading into the Gospel of John a supersessionist or a replacement theology. That arrives at this conclusion that Jesus is somehow the new temple that replaces the old, rather than actually seeing what the text says. The text never mentions, it never uses any of that kind of language. So I kind of fill that out in the chapter six is a long chapter. So you have to kind of read some of the details there. But I try to push against replacement theology, especially in chapter six with Jesus and temple there. But on this on synagogue side on the synagogue side of things, the synagogue or that idea, the synagogue, has played a really important role also, particularly with the historical interpretation of John, right? And so the so-called Johannine community that, again, so the theory goes, that kind of stands behind on a historical level, stands behind the Gospel of John. And so in various kinds of ways, the synagogue has sort of been a stand-in for thinking about Judaism as a whole, right? So that when you see these passages, there's three times in the Gospel of John, John uses this really interesting term. Only John uses it, but aposynagogos, or its various forms, this idea of being, expelled or kicked out of or put out of the synagogue. Where people have suggested, well, because John has those passages, the gospel must be sort of anti-synagogue, or somehow Christ believers are being kicked out of the synagogue, therefore they're being kicked out of Judaism, right? And so what I've tried to suggest based on recent research into synagogue studies is that actually that's not the case at all. If we understand that what John is interested in is a particular kind of synagogue, right? And it's the what I call the public assembly synagogue. And if we understand how public synagogues worked as institutions, these places are full of conflict, left and right, full of diverse interpretations of Torah. They're diverse institutions through and through. What John seems to be interested in is certainly recounting or expressing some sort of conflict, but it's conflict within a public assembly. There's differences over the person of Jesus. Some agree with him, some don't. There's contention. There's a contentious politics that are there, and Christ's followers are being what for whatever whatever reason or however you want to interpret, are being put outside of that, but not outside of Judaism, but outside of a public assembly. But then we this kind of moves into another interpretation then, where Christ followers kicked out of the synagogue could also form their identities and their associations in other kinds of ways, right? And so this is where we have also it's important to sort of unpack other diverse kinds of synagogues, right? There's not just the public assembly type, there's also synagogues formed around other kinds of identity markers. So which are Jewish through and through. So there's not somehow one is more Jewish than the other, or one is Jewish and one is un-Jewish. So being kicked out of a synagogue just meant you were losing the battle for influence within the public assembly, not that you were losing your Jewish identity. So I think this helps kind of reconceive really two key institutions, temple and synagogue, within a Jewish framework for John. And yes, there's conflict, there's renegotiation, there's all these kinds of things that scholars have seen for a long time, but there's really no reason, unless you're imposing a later Christian theological perspective onto the Gospel of John, there's really no reason to read it outside of Judaism. We've got every reason to read it within, I think.
Wally, can you tell us about any other projects you're working on?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. So the Gospel of John, or this work on the Gospel of John, was my dissertation. My revised PhD dissertation published as a book. And so now I've been sort of neck deep into another project, and actually the results of this project are coming out this year with Fortress Press. It's a history of Jews and Christians in the village of Capernaum. So readers of the New Testament will kind of know of that village as an important village in Galilee. That was important to Jesus, but it was also really important to Jews and Christians living there for centuries after Jesus. And so this book works through the archaeology and the literary sources to try to piece together what we can about the history of particularly Jewish Christian interaction from the first century, from around the time of Jesus, all the way through the emergence of Islam in the Eastern Mediterranean in the 7th century. So, a really fun project. I really enjoyed it. But that one's also wrapping up here and will be published in October.
Wally, it's been a delight hearing about your work. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Michael. Really happy to be here, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about it.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.